night. You can also watch the full 2.5-hour event, the celebration of Democracy Now!, at democracynow.org. And that does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guzder, Sam Alkoff, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Sharina Nadura, and Andre Lewis, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, and Paul Huckabee, our engineer. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Miriam Barnard, Aaron Dooley, Hugh Grand, David Prude, R.L. Boone, Vesta Godarz. I'm Amy Goodman. Our website is democracynow.org. Thanks for joining us.
KVU Community Radio holds an open meeting concerning the operations and programming of KVU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KVU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The Program Advisory Committee meets the second Tuesday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held. To request notice of board meetings in writing, please email Monica at kbu.org.
KVU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Oregon Able Savings Plan launch on December 6th at 5 p.m. at the White Stag Building in Portland. The Oregon Able Savings Plan will allow people with disabilities and their families save for the future without losing their state and federal benefits. The disability community has worked for 10 years to pass Able legislation and are holding this event to celebrate and educate others about the opportunity. There will be refreshments, activities for kids, information, and more. Again, that's Oregon Able Savings Plan launch on December 6th at 5 p.m. at the White Stag Building. That's at 70 Northwest Cooch Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Tom Dwyer Automotive Services, a full-service automotive shop located next to Portland's Selwood Bridge for over 30 years. They're a Blue Seal certified shop committed to client care and community support. Information on their eco certification, client carbon neutral program, courtesy shuttle, rentals, and more at tomdwyer.com. Or by calling 503-230-2300.
It's coming through a hole.
Hey, good morning. Good morning. It is Tuesday morning on KBOO 90.7 FM on your radio dial. This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Program. I'm Abe Proctor. Sitting across from me is Dr. Joe Uris.
Yes, I are a doctor.
You are a doctor.
Yeah.
Can you fix people when they're broke?
No.
Okay, then.
I can't. You mean like give them money?
Either that or, you know, set a broken arm, something like that.
Oh, yeah, I can actually, unless it's a compound fracture, set a broken arm.
That's pretty impressive.
Thanks to the Red Cross.
All right.
Now, whether I could set it so it looks okay or doesn't hurt, I don't know.
The number to call today, 503-231-8187. If you want to leave us some written feedback, that's possible. Also, at our Facebook page, facebook.com/Abe and Joe, and also on Twitter, at HonestAbe72. Joe, you're going to explain things to us today.
Yeah, I'm going to start out by talking a little bit about fake news.
All right.
And I'm going to talk about the false information that infuses our entire educational system.
Okay.
And all of which ultimately leads to a non-class, non-real analysis of the situation in America. And I'm going to really talk about that, and it helps to explain the absolute failure of the Democrats in this election, Not that they didn't actually win, if you count the general vote, but the actual failure of the and the consequentiality of that, and how the Trumpy thing is just flowing along. The
okay.
Trumpy thing.
All right.
Okay, so let's start out with the fake news phenomenon. In recent years, it has been possible for the Breitbart-y people and so on to put out incredible fake news stories.
Who are the Breitbart-y people?
The Breitbart-y people are the what are now called the alternate right. They are people who are committed to a very reactionary picture of the United States, anti in any way social caring, in any way commitment to, pardon me, to the real and traditional concerns of working people. Traditional in the sense of better wages, health care, and so on. And this has been growing for some time. It is a reaction essentially to the accomplishments of the Roosevelt administration way back in the 1930s. I think that, and I think it's correct.
You believe fake news is a reaction to the accomplishments of the Roosevelt administration?
Yeah, and ultimately. And fake news, of course, is deliberate. It is deliberate, bizarre propaganda.
Now, I'm presuming you mean that it's a part of it's part of the overall push to undo the accomplishments of the Roosevelt administration.
Yeah, and to
it's
create,
gone on for many decades.
Right, and to create a kind of paranoia about the intention of government.
Okay.
And the legitimacy of government.
And has as its corollary the rise of right-wing talk radio, I would imagine.
Oh, yeah. And right-wing talk radio precedes it, actually.
Yes. So these are all facets of the same problem.
I think so.
Okay.
And I think the society is set up to fall into this pattern.
I would add something significant to that.
Sure.
I would add the peddling of the myth that's now accepted as law by a large section of the electorate, and that is that if you cut taxes on rich people, all that wealth will trickle down to everyone else.
Well, yeah, and that was made popular by Reagan and many others, right. And it's never been true.
Right. Well, but it's widely accepted as true without question. It's
right.
It's an item of dogma on the economic right.
Right. And
despite the lack of any evidence to support it.
It pits the working people against the government rather than the working people against the wealthy, and therefore serves the interests of a ruling class, particularly the reactionary elements of the ruling class. But the fake news phenomenon is quite amazing and has only been able to exist since the time of the creation of Twitter and, you know, and all that other stuff you like so much.
Uh-huh.
Since I don't use these modern devices, I don't have any real appreciation of them. Probably if I used them, I'd be more thoughtful about them, more fair.
So are you drawing a line then between the numerous fake news sites on the internet today and, say, a publication like the National Review?
That's an interesting point. Yes, because most of the articles in the National Review, not all, are based on a position that has, though I don't agree with it, legitimacy in the spectrum of ordinary politics. And I think what has happened is the fake news becomes, doesn't matter how fake it is, there are people in large enough numbers that will buy into it, whatever the story. Just recently, of course, we've seen this guy who heard that this pizza parlor in the Washington, D.C. area was part of Hillary's giant scam to sexualize and exploit children.
Yeah, to run a child a prostitution ring.
Right.
Out of a pizza shop.
Right.
Now, let's think about this for a second. I don't think that would... that phenomena would occur in a vacuum, right? That's not going to occur.
No.
If out of nowhere there was an allegation that Hillary Clinton was running, of all things, a child porn / prostitution ring out of a pizza parlor, that's patently absurd, right?
Right.
But in the context, carefully manufactured context, of years of right-wing propaganda against the Clintons, all of a sudden there's a chunk of the electorate that accepts that as true.
Right. And in fact, instead of having an analysis of the structure of America, looking at where wealth does lie, where power does rest, instead of looking at any of that, you create these wild explanations, these very paranoid explanations for why injustice exists. And that would not happen if it were not for the fact that in the course of the years since Ronald Reagan, I picked that date arbitrarily. It's not a hardcore date. I just want to set it up that way. Since that period of time, we have seen the destruction of security and reasonable income for working class people. By the way, the term working class has disappeared. I don't know if you've noticed that, Abe, but I have.
I have, and you've pointed that out on this program.
Yeah, and it's so we have suddenly we're talking about the middle class and people who used to be able to afford a home, who had an automobile, who could send their children even possibly to college, would look forward to a future that had, because they had a living wage, would include health care, would include potential for their children to have a better education and therefore to move up the economic ladder. All of that now is starting to disappear. It's disappearing because of a vast fact of an international working situation where wages are held unfairly low all over the world and where goods flow into the United States after having been manufactured at wages that cannot allow competition out of the American working class.
In fact, the global situation is very analogous, I think, to the set of conditions here in the United States that led to the rise of the labor movement.
Right.
Wages being held unfairly low, workers being denied the right to organize, to have any power to push back against the ownership class. Only now it's happening on a scale that dwarfs anything we experienced here.
Well, and there's been a change, a very serious change in the presentation and the actual role of the Democratic Party versus the Republican Party. The tradition that one might have grown up with is that the Republicans were the conservative party defending the ruling class and arguing for things like trickle-down economics. In contrast, the Democratic Party argues for the basic rights of working people, for health care, for environmental issues, and for living wages. The Democratic Party, however, beginning with the first Clinton, really turned its attention away from that working class orientation that made it the Democratic Party so powerful in the Roosevelt era and well into the modern times. Now, suddenly, the party is not so clearly supporting the working class. Suddenly, Hillary Rodham Clinton and others talk about the middle class and move away, eschew, as it were, all references to the class structure in actuality. And this has happened a lot. And it now has come to be payback time where the Democrats were cast adrift. And, of course, it opened up the opportunities, which, as you pointed out, have been unending to brand the Clintons as criminals. In fact, I know people on the left who honestly believe, without any real substantial evidence of any sort, that the Clintons are crooks. And that's, you know, it's considered now almost a reality. Popular reality. And I can remember, I often go to the Saturday market and I get into conversations with people who raised animals for food or who grew vegetables, who would say very seriously, well, she's a crook. And of course, this is the fruit of a vast, unending propaganda campaign to disengage the American people from the Democratic Party. Hillary Clinton did not and could not adequately respond to that. I want to make another point here that's really important. Hillary Clinton won the popular vote. She won it by 2-point-something million. What we don't have popular elections. The founding fathers, and remember, there were no founding mothers, there were no persons of color. The founding fathers essentially wanted to create a limited republic. And the way they did that was to create a system that checked and balanced any effort by ordinary people to gain power. And this is something we were never taught in school. And that brings me to my next point. Our educational system is filled with myths and lies. I doubt that anyone, even people quite a bit younger than you or I, didn't hear the story of George Washington and the cherry tree. Didn't hear the story of Abe Lincoln's enormous honesty, didn't hear all kinds of mythic things about American history in which, in essence, everything America does, everything the government does, everything, every expansion that took place, regardless of its genocidal nature or whatever, everything was good. history was good.
See, that does not describe my public school education in the slightest.
Really?
No.
Where'd you go to school?
In California, Northern California.
And you had critical?
Yeah. For example, those first two mythic examples, Abe Lincoln's honesty and Washington and the cherry tree, we were told in no uncertain terms that those were, in fact, myths. And we even got some instruction on the usefulness of those myths and
really?
Why they persist. Yes, indeed.
See, I didn't have that experience.
I was taught that the genocide of the Native Americans was essentially unforgivable, but also that there was nothing we could do about it now. There was a pretty clear-eyed presentation. I'm talking about in high school now, when I was old enough to really sort of get my brain around these things. There was a clear-eyed presentation of slavery and of Jim Crow. And of the conditions that led to the civil rights movement in the 1960s.
Well, you're younger than I am. Maybe schooling has changed to a great extent. Mm-hmm. My experience was essentially very reactionary. I was taught, and I think I've mentioned this before, but I was taught that, yeah, slavery was bad, but after all, these were people who could handle the hot weather.
Now, see, we got some of that too, but it was in the context of these were the false justifications that people employed to defend slavery.
Right. So you got a better education than I did in terms of the truth of power relations. And I can't speak to how ubiquitous your experience was compared to mine.
I can't really either, but I'm led to suspect that what I just described to you, which conservatives might describe as a politically correct rewriting of history, is part of the broader conservative backlash against what they perceive to be a liberally biased education system.
So the things you learned, as opposed to the things I learned, are now criticized and attacked by the Breitbarters and so on.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's leave it at that. But the larger point that I want to make is that working people, since the Clinton administration, the Bill Clinton administration, have not fared as well as they had in the previous decades.
No.
And the consequence of that, lacking a class analysis, lacking an understanding of power relations, lacking an understanding of international trade and so on, is an enormous degree of loss and rage that cannot be met within the context of the usual liberal to conservative analysis. And this sets things up for what happened in this election. And I think that's really, really important. Also, what also happened, of course, was that a lot of people simply didn't bother to vote. They didn't like Hillary Clinton for one reason or another. They didn't see her as the champion of the working class. All kinds of things like that, I think, took place. Meanwhile, Trump simply lied about everything and was very entertaining in his lying and was supported by the media, which allowed him, as the boss, to fire everyone, a certain kind of authority that should never be attached to the presidency.
Sure.
So that's what happened. That's where we are. And that's going to be hard to undo.
Yeah, I would agree.
So I just wanted to throw that out there and to make sure people, I don't think it's a problem with most of our audience, but make sure people realize that this, all of what's going on right now, is not some kind of odd accident. It really is part of a struggle that is taking place between those, I'll call them, for lack of a better word, hyper-conservatives, and actually the rest of us. But my argument also is that in the context of what people know in general, what they think in general about what's going on in this country, we're locked in to a false set of patterns.
Okay. I want to unpack this a little bit, but I think we ought to maybe give our callers
a chance. Yeah, people, I have to say this too. A lot of people get angry at us. We talk too much. They want to hear, they want to get on the air. This is their talk program. So let's go to that. 231-8187.
Who's next? Or who's first? Brian, good morning.
Good morning. How could we ever be angry at you two?
Oh, easily.
Oh, it happens.
There's no way. So listen, I just want to say something about, basically related to what you said. Before the election, and everybody was running around, you know, and my friends were all running around, and they were smart, and they said, "Hey, this is the end of the Democrat. This is the end of the Republican Party," and I was like, "You know, I believe this. You know, I mean, there's no way." And everybody was laughing at Trump. I stopped laughing at Trump about 6 months ago. I don't think anything he said was funny ever, and I don't think anything anybody said about him was funny, because I just started realizing how dangerous he was. But the bottom line goes like this, you know, I did go on that line. And now on the BBC after the election, after Trump was elected, BBC was announcing the end of the Democratic Party. You know, this is it for them. I mean, they're in shambles, they're wrecked. And I tend to agree with it, but my point relates back to something I heard this morning, and why I'm calling is, you know, Noam Chomsky on that on the Amy Goodman show today, you know, when he was doing part of his speech, was how we are being isolated by the rest of the world. And Trump is just accelerating that. And, you know, South America is isolating us, you know, and China and everybody else is starting to isolate us. And they were doing this years ago because of our bizarre behavior. But now I think trying to explain to each other, and I think that's what we're doing now, explain to each other and rationalize Donald Trump and what he is going to do. It's only a discussion inside our country. As far as the rest of the world, they are trying desperately to find a way to write us off. And I believe in the spirit of human spirit, they will find a way to write us off, because we have to back off and look at ourselves. For the past 40 or 50 years, or and longer, but mostly, you know, since really Nixon and Reagan, we are an extremely dangerous country. And nowadays, we are extremely weak and dangerous, you know, but, you know, we can still bite. And that's just my comment about the whole thing. You know, having a discussion about Donald Trump is all well and good, and he did get elected to President of the United States. But the bottom line is, it's absurd, because you can't discuss this uncontrolled, unmedicated insanity, you know, and predict anything at all, because the outcomes are completely unpredictable. But that was just my comment about it. I think we need to stop explaining this whole thing and trying to deal with it, and start, unfortunately, and not violently at all, I don't advocate that, but we need to start reacting to it, and, in a very, very strong way, because the world is reacting to it. But that's just what I have to say.
Hey, thanks for the call, man.
You have a great day.
You take care. We're talking, if you're just tuning in, first of all, this is KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial. We're talking about the phenomenon, and for me, this may be the last time I discuss this, at least for a while, of the rejection of the Democratic Party in the election. And I want to make this clear. In fact, the actual vote was more than 2 million popular votes ahead of what the Republicans achieved. The system is set up in such a way that the Electoral College defeats the popular vote twice, at least in my lifetime. And this is not something that can be easily repaired. There are two ways to change this. One would be through the usual amendment process, which brings the legislature, the federal legislature, into the process and so on, and the state governments. In the other alternative, a general convention is called. And that can be terrifying, because anything can be brought up in a convention that changes the Constitution. So we're in an interesting situation in that respect. And I don't know that we're ever going to be able to solve that particular problem within the context of a current system. And I don't expect there to be a major left-wing revolution in America, more likely some kind of right-wing changes. And I don't know. I really want to hear from people. But the point I wanted to make, and I think it's really important, is that, in fact, and this is where Abe and I disagree coming out of our own educational experiences, in fact, what I learned in school And what I think a lot of people learn in school is mythology rather than fact, particularly about history.
I learned the mythology too, but I also received an explanation of why it was myth, the purpose that it served, and even why it came to be.
Well, did you go to public school?
I did.
And it was better than the public school I went to.
I don't know. It may come down to, you know, the individual teachers I had. I had an economics instructor in high school. Shout out, Mr. Shank, if you're listening. you know, and we learned in no uncertain terms why Roosevelt's New Deal worked, what Keynesian demand-side economics was, mm-hmm. why it was a far better use of government power to support the working class and put money in people's pockets, why that was a far better tack to take economically than supply-side economics. Supply-side economics at the time, this was the late 80s, was in full swing. So we were really seeing for the first time the stark contrast in terms of everything from our nation's balance sheet to the state of employment to the concentration of wealth, the difference between the paradigm shift that happened under Reagan's administration compared to what had prevailed the post-war liberal consensus mm-hmm. that Roosevelt put in place. I learned all that was all spelled out very clearly to me. Here's demand-side economics and why it works. Here's supply-side economics and why it does not. This was in high school economics.
Well, I learned those things, but outside of school.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that most of the people I knew, if they learned anything in school, and I have often thought rock and roll is right on this question when I consider all the whatever that I mm-hmm. learned in high school, blah, 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 I think it's really a continuing problem, although your experience defies my stereotypes.
When we talk about and it's a widespread topic of conversation on both sides of the political divide, the general degradation of public education in the United States, mm-hmm. which I think is true. I think that is more telling, or let me put it this way. The myth-making you're talking about, that's less the problem than the actual number of people who, first of all, are earning high school diplomas, and secondly, leaving school with some degree of literacy and numeracy. Those things have all fallen. And that, I think, is the heart of the problem. But it's less important than the myth-making you're talking about.
Yeah, and I want to point out two things that are important about this conversation. The first, and it's an obvious one, most of you will recognize it, is that at the beginning of National Socialism in Germany, mm-hmm. A right-wing political philosophy, people laughed at Hitler. He was perceived as a clown, much the same way that people laugh at Trump, who don't like Trump and perceive him as a clown. That perception of Hitler or Trump was not wrong. It simply didn't understand the anger, the pent-up resentment. In the case of Germany, the resentment of an unfair solution to World War I and the rise of an incredible fascist movement throughout Europe. That's one thing. The other example is actually Brexit, where people voted in England angrily against European unity without understanding that they really were voting against the economic structure that had been built over a number of years.
Right. And as we discussed on this program, that was, I think, best understood through a prism of English nationalism.
Right.
And I think you can apply that same prism, not English nationalism, obviously, to the results of the election here in the United States.
And when you add in things like fake news and the fact that most people, and this is, I don't have good data on this, but I believe it's so, most people really don't, they're not really interested in the news. The news is kind of, you listen to it or you watch it kind of in a casual and dutiful way. And the fact of the matter is that the what's going on is very complex. Most people don't read the New York Times. Most people don't read Time magazine, for that matter. It's a culture that is involved in escapism. What Trump did with his "you're fired" nonsense, his apprentice programming, was create an authoritarian boss who made things right for an audience of true believers. And that was never criticized. That was, I think, NBC. It went on and on and on. Nobody ever said of it, oh, this is silly. Or if they did say it, they said it in intellectual circles rather than common circles.
Hmm.
And it was very popular.
Well, I do have some data that might shed a little more
light. Not data. Oh, yeah. No, not data.
That might shed a little more light on this, but I think we should take some calls first. Who's next? Bill, good morning.
Good morning. I called in a couple of weeks ago after a man who had expressed hope that the election wasn't really established by the declarations on November 8th, but that, in fact, the Electoral College can come to a safe landing. And Joe's response was, it's not going to happen. And I called in quite angry then. Uh-huh. And I've continued to follow this. And I think we should be looking to the view of Professor Lawrence Lessig at Harvard, constitutional law, mm-hmm. which expresses that the Constitution's primacy is that of one man, one vote. And where states have mandated winner-take-all, that's not in keeping with the Constitution and can be reversed in time before December 19th. I don't know who's acting on this, but that's not really the outcome I wish that the popular vote would carry. I think that the key thing that will justify this for the electors is the proof of crime by Republican state secretaries of state, maybe some of them going to jail. And then the Republicans are disgraced, but the Democrats must be equally disgraced. So my push is that Hillary Clinton should get up on national television and condemn the theft of democracy by both parties, a resolve that it's going to change, and that the way for it to change is to step aside and let Bernie carry it all so we can all become friends again.
I don't think that's going to happen, Bill.
Well, why do you have to say that? Can't we look to the challenging of election results, hopefully, for a reason, and to support them, to send our money to ensure these recounts happen? Let's not let that fail.
Well, thank you very much for the call. You know, the recount efforts that are underway in those swing states that more or less tipped the election in Trump's favor, I think they're still progressing in two of the three states.
Right. Well, it's Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan.
Yeah. I support those. Absolutely. You know, they're
me too. Me too.
Oh, yeah. There's a whole pile, a growing pile of evidence to suggest that what really tipped the scales there was not an overwhelming sense of harmony between the white working class voters and Donald Trump, but rather voter suppression tactics by the right, keeping the wrong people from voting, as it were. That's a much bigger factor, the evidence suggests, than any sort of loyalty or resonance with Trump among white voters.
Well, I agree with you. Right. I mean, when you get right down to it, that is clearly the case.
Yes, voter suppression, a huge factor in this election. We probably will not know exactly the dimensions of that factor until a lot more research is conducted.
And we've always had a history nationally in every election of that kind of, or some other kind of suppression of vote.
Yes. Turnout, also a problem. Of course, suppression has an effect on turnout. But many millions of people did not turn out to vote this time around compared with 2012 and particularly 2008. So those are huge factors.
You were going to give us some factoids.
I was, yes. But first, to Bill's point, is Hillary Clinton going to stand up and denounce in no uncertain terms the actions of both major political parties and then hand things over to Bernie? No, that's not going to happen.
Well, and Bernie wouldn't do it.
No, I don't think he would.
He believes in the mandate and in democracy. And
yeah, I also am not on board with this push to get electors to cast their electoral votes contrary to the popular results in their states, in the winner-take-all states. I'm not about that.
Well, it's not going to
go into an election with the system you have, however flawed. And if we collectively have any belief in democratic institutions and their enduring value, and let me put this out there, folks, in case you're one of the sort of the burn-it-all-down crowd, it's far better to have faith in democratic institutions and their value than it is to live in a state of constant revolt.
I don't know. I don't know. I have to think about that. Yeah. You're talking about an existential position, really.
No, not really. I'm talking, is it better to accept the lousy results of this election and go forward and try to fix things next time around? Is it better to do that, or is it better to contest the outcome of this election and get the electors to change their tune? Well, I think it's far better to accept the results and go on. You don't want to undermine, you don't want to corrode democratic institutions any further than they have already been corroded.
Well, that latter point is an interesting point, but I don't think it's a better or worser thing. It's a strategic question.
There's no winners in civil war, Joe. There's no spoils of war in a civil war.
Sure, okay? There is.
No, there's not.
I don't know. I think that one of the things that happened as a consequence of the American Civil War was the effective destruction of the economic powerhouse of the South. And that was accomplished through a number of devices, one of which was the freedom of African Americans.
I don't want to go too far down this road. The point I'm trying to make is, should the Electoral College be abolished? In my opinion, yes. But if that's the case, let's do it the way we're supposed to do it.
Okay,
let's
amend the Constitution. I'm not going to argue with that.
Okay. I do have some statistics I want to get to, but let's go back to the phones first. Steve. Oh, we lost Steve. Anybody else? Hey. King Joffrey.
Yes.
Your Grace. Good morning.
Oh, yes. That's me. Back to life again.
Maybe Trump will have a purple wedding. Maybe that would solve the problem.
I'll keep this short because partly like the same point I wanted to call in about was covered by the previous caller, basically voter suppression. But what I wanted to say, just to kind of join in, like my public school education also, like at least at high school level, did not like reinforce the myths, but rather sort of tried to discuss, you know, more reality behind the stories of our political history. Mm-hmm. But also, you know, the massive voter suppression. I mean, we've been listening for like decades about the gerrymandering and the voter suppression via like voter ID and other means, you know, keeping people from voting by dramatically decreasing their polls available so that they don't get to vote, or they're
keeping
extremely discouraged from voting.
Keeping certain kinds of people from voting. Let's be very careful here.
Yes,
let's be specific.
Sorry, that's right. That's more or less what I meant. Sorry.
Right. I know you did. Go ahead.
And also the, you know, as discussed in like the Ballot Bandits book about like using the myth of voter fraud, duplicate voting, in order to just remove huge chunks of you know, certain ethnical populations from, like, you know, legally voting by just removing them from the voting list.
Well, that's certainly, all that's true. I mean, I think that a lot of that it is true, really. Anyway, thanks.
If you say that most of that's true, then it's hard to say, like, well, the voters didn't turn out, because you're saying on the one hand they were kept from voting, so how do you know if they turned out or if they would have turned out?
I'm saying the statistics indicate that both things are true, that people the vote suppression effort was effective, and also people didn't bother to turn out.
I want to say something that is not directly germane to this conversation, but I wish we had more female callers.
I do too, and I think it is germane to this conversation, actually. Okay, so to the statistics, to the data.
Data!
To the data! So there's sort of this analysis floating around out there that Hillary Clinton lost the election because the white working class failed to hear her message.
Okay, that is one of the myths about this election.
Yes, and I think it's very much a myth. Now, in my opinion, Hillary Clinton was a very flawed candidate. Too cozy with moneyed interests, for example.
Okay.
But if you look at her website, which I did in preparation for this program, she outlines what has to be called, by any measure, an incredibly progressive platform for the middle and working classes across the board. It's pretty impressive, actually. And if we give her the benefit of the doubt and say that she would have done her utmost to implement this platform, then she will, I could say this, I think, with a high degree of confidence. And if you dispute this, go ahead and look at her website. Now, again, it's an open question whether or not she would have been able to make this all happen. But if she were, then we would have been well on our way to something much that resembles much more closely the social democracy that's practiced in some of the northern European countries. It certainly puts us down that path. So I think the problem is not that white working class voters failed to hear Hillary Clinton's message. I think it's that they heard her message and decided they didn't want it. Consider this. Among the 52% of voters who said that jobs and the economy were the most important issues in the election, 52% of voters said that the economy was the most important thing. Clinton beat Trump by double digits. Mm-hmm. In a strong majority of swing states, voters said they preferred her positions on the economy. So when you look at the statistics, the only two demographic groups to give a majority of their votes to Donald Trump were white people, white men and white women. That says to me that they heard Hillary Clinton's message of a pluralistic democracy and rejected it. That says to me that white identity was a pretty big factor in determining the outcome of this election.
So you're saying that a kind of racist conception of America overwhelmed any kind of rational class-based discussion.
Yes. Most working-class white voters, according, again, to statistics, don't want to see anything happen, for example, to Medicare or to Social Security, because they and people who look like them largely depend on those programs. However, they're quite eager to dismantle something like Obamacare, which has a much more diverse set of constituents who benefit from it. I think that you cannot ignore white identity in the outcome of this election. Now, am I saying that every Trump voter is a racist, a homophobe, a xenophobe? No. But enough Trump voters voted for a guy for whom those it wasn't a deal breaker for them. Maybe they're not racist themselves, but the fact that their candidate was a racist, that wasn't a deal breaker.
Well, it's also possible that people thought it was funny.
Let me finish here.
A lot of the Brexit voters thought it was funny, and thought it was like a gesture, a symbolic behavior. And I wonder to what degree, and I haven't got an answer to this, what we really saw here was simply a willful, unknowing rebellion against establishment ideas. And I think that's something to think about here.
Yeah, I think there was pushback against establishment ideas on for both major party candidates. But the fact remains, white people supported Trump by pretty large majorities, mostly a larger majority by white men. And I think it's safe to say that for those people who voted for him, if they're not racist themselves, they were willing to accept a guy who is.
I think the latter. I think what you just said is true. And I also think that it raises, again, going back to what I started with, the fact that we live in a racist society. We live in a sexist society. We live in a society where there's no really good class analysis. And that those things are very, very real and came back to bite us in this election.
I would agree with that.
And I think we should hear some more of our callers.
Dave, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Sure. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm calling, I'm just listening to you guys talk, and so I got a few more things on my mind here. But I just want to say I am a white working class voter. I am a Catholic anarchist, so I don't traditionally get pulled into electoral politics in the past, but I did during this election. I think that definitely racism and patriarchy and heterosexism play big roles in the outcome of this election. But I think it would be a mistake to overlook the big middle finger that went up from a lot of people. I think when you talk about a symbolic vote, I think that was a big part of this vote for Trump. I come from rural Oregon, and so I know racism and sexism well, and I know white working class politics well. And I think a lot of the people that I love dearly voted for Trump, and not because they liked his policies, and not because they don't like women, or not because they don't like black people, but they voted for Trump because they were tired of only getting one option. And here comes this other option that they, I think, all thought would be a very horrible thing. But they're looking at the reality of their situation And they're saying, really, what's the difference? You know, I think that question came up a lot during this election, people I talked to. And whether that's based in reality or not is separate from the fact that that was, you know, what was going through their mind. What's the difference? Like, what's going to change? You know, we're looking at climate catastrophe. What's going to change? Like, we're looking at, you know, Hillary Clinton standing up there and saying, you know, no, absolutely not to single-payer health care. Well, I got to tell you, I got a special needs son. I can't go back to a system where they can deny him health care, but Obamacare is not working for me either. You know, anything but universal health care, I'm pretty much screwed. So that question, again, is what does it matter? And I think that there really is a big difference, and it does matter. But that's the question that's going through, and that's why Hillary Clinton failed, because she failed to address that. And then the thing that I called about originally that I just want to touch on real quick is that this whole recount thing. I know the Greens have spent like something like $6 million. I think that probably a lot more money has gone into it than that. Nothing's going to I want to be clear to all the listeners out there. Nothing's going to happen through this recount to change the fact that Donald Trump is going into office. And I want to encourage everyone, if you have only a few dollars in your pocket and you're thinking about giving it to the Green Party or someone that's behind a recount because you really think it's going to make a difference, I think that you should reconsider and possibly give your money to an organization like Black Lives Matter or No DAPL, who's going to continue on the struggle and the fight long after Trump takes office. So that's what I called about, and thanks for having me on.
Well, thank you for the comments. And very, very useful perspective. I'm losing it. I do think also, and I think this is very important, that we are, you know, we were arguing at the beginning about what kind of education, respectively, we too had in the public system. But I do think that class politics has no real place, no legitimacy, and no understanding in the lives of most people at this point in America. And one of the ways in which that's avoided, of course, is through the creation of enormous debt, which allows one to live a kind of reality which is fictitive, ultimately. We have all these toys, including houses, that seem to speak to the idea that we're successful. And yet we're only, I would say, a few thousand dollars away from bankruptcy, many of us. So we're therefore both addicted to and stuck in a situation where we're not about to throw away what we have perceived as gains that have been made in our lives. And at the same time, there's a huge indication that many people in many parts of the country are not able to have a living wage. And that's all real. And yet the way in which all of that is blamed, the way people turn their attention to it, is not unlike the attitudes of blaming the victim that we saw in Europe in the 1930s.
Yeah, that's very true. Trump really managed to pull off one of the great cons in American history.
Yeah.
He convinced millions of voters that their economic woes were to be blamed on masses of people streaming over the southern border, rather than the rulership class of which Trump is a prominent member. It was a fantastic bait and switch, really.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the guy was encouraged by the popularity of his trivial TV shows. He was supported by the media throughout all of his growing career as an opportunistic presenter of a vicious kind of capitalism. The fact that he is, in fact, a guy who doesn't pay his bills, a guy who always walks away from the deal, the art of the deal, leaving others in his wake damaged and abused while he pockets the change. I mean, all that's real, but there's almost an admiration for that, kind of the fictitive admiration for the bank robber or somebody like that.
Hmm. Mark writes in to the Facebook page, facebook.com/Abe and Joe, to say, the Canadian dollar has a value of around 75 cents to the American dollar, so Canada is a big discount shop for Americans. A week ago, Trump derided Canada as a, quote, big league deficit country, end quote. Are the super rich oblivious to facts and correction? Do the elites transfigure the power of wealth so that they never have to learn from other countries or admit that the social contract tames the market and counters the wolfishness of subjects? Without the social contract, will we become wolves to one another? In truth, all personal and corporate achievement is based on public investment in roads, schools, airwaves, hospitals, food safety, water quality, community centers, and cloud workers. I'm not sure what cloud workers are, but there it is.
Well, I think they have wings and they...
Something like that, yeah. I think, yes. Yeah, I think a huge amount of wealth does fundamentally alter the way someone perceives the world.
Well, of course. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, I think that the fact that... I would be much more desperate if I didn't have the advantages of PERS and things like that. You know, probably you would be too.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So, really, yeah. And there's been a lot of very good theater that was written during the 30s that talks about this. I think it's a very real thing.
Yeah, I agree.
And in fact, one's class situation has enormous and profound impact in the current world.
Yeah. Let's go to the phones. Pascal, good morning.
Hi. I just wanted to intervene. First of all, you guys said that you don't have any female callers. So
we have not enough. Not enough female callers.
I'll do this very quick.
Okay.
I want to say what got me to kind of react was the statement that people did not like the platform offered by Hillary Clinton, and that may be a reason why they did not turn out to vote or did not vote for her. I disagree with that, frankly. I think it's more the fact that in our case, at least myself, my husband, I was pretty much enraged when I found out that the nomination had been promised to her by the Democratic Party. Instead, you know, in 2015, instead of waiting, whatever, we felt that Bernie Sanders was the best candidate. He is the candidate that we would have wanted. Had Bernie been nominated, I think the whole entire turnout would have been different. There would have been more people voting. In the case of our family, we have... I talked with one of our children who actually wrote in Bernie Sanders because they were frustrated. And even though we know that doesn't count once you write somebody's name in and whatever, and they're not the main people, mm-hmm. the main, you know. We voted for Hillary. We've pretty much waited till the last minute, and we did it very reluctantly and resentfully. And it's not a matter of platform, because we would have liked a progressive platform, obviously. But that's our situation. I just don't think that people went like, oh, she's too liberal. We're not going to turn out to vote. I don't think that's the case.
Okay. I think you're making a very good point. And I think that we are still struggling to understand exactly where people's heads and hearts are in this process. I definitely think that
I think that there's just widespread corruption with both parties. And
right.
We have basically two of the same.
Well, I think you're largely right. And I think that it was very disturbing to many people to watch the way in which the party machine of the Democratic Party was perceived, and in many cases truly was, working to prevent the possibility of Bernie Sanders being the actual candidate of the Democratic Party.
Exactly, and I also, I don't know, it's just, I just remember a statement that Ross Nader made years ago that in the United States, you have more choice in the cereal aisle than you do in political parties, you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, it's Lucky Charms versus the sweetened, poisoned tiger.
You know, you get a false feeling of choice when it's basically the same, you know, same old. Anyway, that's what I wanted to say.
Thank you very much.
This is not same old, this is scary. But.
I agree. Hey, thank you, Pascal, for the call.
Yeah, and I think she's making another very important point. This is not a lightweight situation. This is a heavy situation. This is a serious situation. Mm-hmm. Already we see the cabinet being packed with the most reactionary elements of the ruling class and people who really are not qualified in positions of great power.
Yes.
And this is all going to be going down for at least 4 years.
I understand retired General David Petraeus, who was busted for mishandling classified information.
He gave his lover stuff.
Yeah, yeah. He's on the short list for Secretary of State. So presumably, if he were to visit other heads of state elsewhere in the world, he would need a note from his probation officer.
No, no. He's done with that.
He's still on probation.
He's on probation?
Yes, he is. Yeah, he didn't do any time.
Oh. Huh. Well, okay. And then there's, what's his name? General Flynn. General Flynn, yeah. Who is crazy.
Mad Dog.
It's
his nickname.
No, the other guy's Mad Dog.
Flynn was Mad Dog. To the question of whether Bernie Sanders would have won this election, I don't know.
You can't answer that.
Well, no, you can't. Based upon what most people know about him, you're tempted to say yes. But I want to refer people to an article in Newsweek by Kurt Eichenwald, in which he describes getting a look at the opposition research that the Republicans did on Senator Sanders. And it was not good. They would have been able to pillory him up one side and down the other. And I want to go into detail, but I encourage our listeners to go read that.
Yeah, that's true. He had a little bit of a wild life.
Yeah.
And a little bit irresponsible earlier. Yep. And he definitely had, and it does have, a social democratic perspective.
Yep.
And that is attackable from the right.
It is. You're absolutely correct.
So, yeah, maybe we're all just thinking, he should have been allowed. The fact, though, is that the way in which the electoral process was carried out, the selection process for both the Democratic and Republican candidates, was so flawed and so superficial and so ugly that we don't have any idea what good candidates would have been, who would have been good candidates and what they would have looked like.
Yeah.
So, there it is.
Except Elizabeth Warren.
Well, Elizabeth Warren wouldn't run.
No,
under these circumstances.
No, she wouldn't. Let's go to the phones. Francis, good morning.
Hi. So, were these bad things about Bernie any more risque than Donald?
No.
No, not risque, but different. I encourage you to go read the article. It was eye-opening.
What's it called again?
It's by Kurt Eichenwald. It's in Newsweek magazine. If you Google it, you can find it.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
And I do agree with that. Your last woman caller who said that a lot of people were upset with how the Democratic Party, they believe, stole the election or the nomination from Bernie Sanders in Nevada and California. But what are people afraid of the most with Trump? I'm wondering what the biggest fear is. Do you guys?
I can tell you what my biggest fear is.
Uh-huh.
My biggest fear is that there will be another large-scale terrorist attack on American soil while he is president. And then the backlash from that will be something the likes of which we have never seen. It will make post-9/11 environment pale in comparison.
So you're thinking...
As far as police...
Yes.
People in prison and all that stuff. Those systems are already in place.
Yes, they are.
But also...
They have been in place for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. And we've been ignoring them because only those other people have been... subject to it.
Well, the thing I fear, Francis, is a little different than, it doesn't disagree with what Abe is saying, but my real fear is the possibility that Trump will not understand the implications of nuclear war and will go to the atomic bomb in response to an attack.
That is really scary. One good thing that happened yesterday, if anybody wants to look for some light in there, is that he met with Al Gore. He and his daughter met with Al Gore yesterday and had a very long conversation. And Al Gore said they're not through yet. So I don't know. I worry more about the people he surrounded himself than he himself, actually, because I think he is open to discussion and considering other points of view. But I don't know that those people that he's decided to surround himself with are.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. Just like you. I don't know.
Sessions and... His vice president, those people are more concerning to me than he is.
Well, and I agree with that part of what you just said. But there's really something important about him that can't be ignored, which is...
And the one thing that I hope that he...
Well, let me just say this real quickly. He's a child with the intellect of a child. Now, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, a friend of mine one time said, I can't remember who said this to me, they woke up one day and their nightmare was that the people who were running things in high school are still running things.
And, I like that.
And that might be to a certain extent. But I hope that he, because there's been so much hatred and racism demonstrated because people feel that under his color they have the power to be hateful, that he has something within himself to make a speech that is just on that subject and to tell these people to back off because they're being really hateful and mean and cruel and doing some ugly things.
I hope he does it, Francis, yeah. But I don't have a lot of hope on that front.
I know. You take care.
You too. Thanks for the call.
Thank you very much for the call. I don't know how much more time over the weeks we're going to spend on the Trump phenomenon.
I suspect we'll revisit it.
Kind of stuck with it.
Yeah. Once his cabinet becomes more fleshed out, I think we're going to need to talk about those folks. but for, you know, for lefties with a news addiction problem like us, these are bumper times.
I don't have a news addiction.
I do.
I don't listen. I don't pay any attention to anything.
Yes. That's why you host a talk show. Because yes. You pay attention to nothing.
Okay, that's all good. You stay tuned because it's the best in music and public affairs here on KBOO.
It's coming from the field that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to sponsor the Elysian Brewing Breakbeat IPA KBOO Benefit on December 8th at the Liquor Store Bar and Venue in Portland. KBOO and Elysian Brewing will celebrate the release of the Manic IPA series with hip-hop, funk, and electronica spun by The Pariahs, DJ Dakimba, and Vinology. Again, that's Elysian Brewing Breakbeat IPA KBOO Benefit on December 8th at the Liquor Store Bar and Venue, 3341 Southeast Belmont Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.